Hi, my name is Joe Fitzgerald. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm glad to be here. It is hot here. Oh, God. I was in Florida about 2 weeks ago, and I thought it was hot there, but actually it was hotter in Florida. Oh, God. But anyway, great talk. Where'd she go? Anyway, she went to buy back her motorcycle. Anyway, you'll never have to worry about me getting a motorcycle. It'll ruin my hair. And anyway, I'd like to thank the committee and Sally and Keith. And is it TC? Love the guy from Central Office. Yeah, he's great for, you know, making this all possible. You know, if you're new in AA, there is no way. I'm the class of 75. I got sober in 1975, which is great, which is a miracle. Unlike most people in 1975, I was only 4 years old, though. Anyway, I'm glad I came. I got sober in 1975. I was 33, and I made that call, and I will forever be grateful. I'm sober like 29 years and 3 months and whatever. Anyway, and I never, if you're new in AA, I never, if someone would have told me then that I would stay sober for 29 years, I would be no way. I would have said no way. And if they would have told me you would be 62 years old one day, I would have said no way, you know? I did not want to be, I just didn't want, I could not see, you know, beyond that. And I'm so grateful. And as it was mentioned earlier, we are so lucky. I mean, I come here all the way to Palm Springs, and do you know how many people I know in these rooms that I've seen you somewhere? It's all meetings, and the people that keep going to meetings, we run into each other. It's just unbelievable. We are so fortunate. So anyway, I love AA. I was born February 12, 1942 in Chicago, and you know, I didn't really know of Chicago. Are you Chicago late? Isn't that, Chicago's the best place. Best place for alcoholics. And anyway, you have to drink because it's so cold and too hot during the summer. But anyway, I love everything that I've learned about alcoholism or learned about myself, I've actually learned in AA. When I came through the doors, I'm so grateful. When I came through the doors of AA, I did not know what an alcoholic was. I had no idea. I knew nothing about alcoholism. I was surrounded by alcoholics all my life. You know, my mother and father are both alcoholics. My uncle John died of cirrhosis of the liver. My brother is still a practicing alcoholic. And I have a great niece, Ashley, who just has about 3 months. Just turned 18. She's been doing heroin since 14 years old. It's unbelievable. But in Chicago, she's in Chicago. But anyway, she's on the right road. You know, I just talked to her. She called me. She told my sister, who is her grandmother, she said, I would like to call Uncle Joe. And, you know, I'm usually the last one to know. After 29 years, you'd think they would call me. But no, she finally called and said she didn't realize how much alcoholism is on our family. And so what we talked. We had a great talk. So anyway, I wish her well. Anyway, so when I came through the doors of AA, I heard people saying being the middle child, they felt different, and I am the middle child. You know, I have an older brother and a younger sister, and I always felt different, and my family always pointed out that I was different. I was 4.5 pounds, and I don't know about you, but I was in a hurry. When I look back on my life, I just wanted to get out. My mother said, you could not wait. You know, I was 4.5 pounds come flying out. And my father worked on the railroad. You know, I still remember my father, believe it or not, when I came out of the wound. And, you know, my father had his coveralls on, his railroad outfit, and his hat, and he was looking. And my mother said, the only difference between you and your brother is when you come flying out, you had a big pink bow in your hair. And, you know, which is amazing, you know. Children were born different in the 40s, and, you know, and I still remember, we are not Jewish, we're Irish and Italian, but my father, when he saw me, he said, oy vey, you know, and, And you know, my mother said, she told me this a long time, and you lived up to the expectations of that pink bow. I became this very pretty little boy, and I had big eyes and real long eyelashes, and I had a high-pitched voice. God gave me this high-pitched voice. I wore long dresses and heels and twirled a lot, and you know, I didn't know any better. And I still remember, you know, it's funny how you remember things. I still remember that look on my father. He'd come home from work, and he was always on guard, I think, when he came home, you know, and he'd look and see my brother, you know, playing baseball outside with his friends, and my sister was always on the floor with her dolls, and I was always in full drag, just twirling around. And he used to come in one door and go out the other, you know, and when I got sober, I thought, oh my God, my first amends was to my father. I thought, I drove that man to alcoholism, you know, and but I learned in AA, you do not drive people to alcoholism. We drive ourselves, you know, and anyway, so, you know, I learned, you know, I am so grateful. You know, as most of us know, older people, you know, we're older, and I'm so proud of it. And I just filed for Social Security. I'll get $865 a month. I've worked so hard, I deserve it. And anyway, it's great. It's a blessing. It's a blessing. It's a miracle. It's a miracle. And I don't need the money, thank God. Praise the Lord. And but the reality is, you know, I learned very early in that family that we were poor. And I learned very early, no one really told me. I knew that if you wanted any extras out of life, you have to go to work. And I swear to God, I start working in the fourth grade, and I have never been unemployed. And, you know, and I was the one that, you know, when coming from that alcoholic home, I cleaned a lot. And you know, my mother was a stay-at-home mom, but my mother did have a lot of problems. She had, you know, which... children and all that. God bless her. She was. Anyway. So, but she was on the couch a lot. You know, she took pills and whatever. She had real problems and not so real problems. You know, in those days, they didn't know a lot of stuff like they know today. But the reality is, I learned very early in that family that you have to go to work. And I think I bought my first three-wheeler. That's how it was in that family. And but what happened is my parents got divorced. Finally, they got divorced. I was in the fifth grade. We moved from the north side of Chicago to the south side of Chicago. We moved to a place called the Bridgeport Housing Projects. And I am 32nd and Halstead Street, actually 32nd and Lithuanica. And I am so grateful because for us, that was a step up. It was a nice little townhouse, a living room and kitchen, and two bedrooms upstairs and a bathroom, and all concrete. And anyway, it was great. We loved it. I have great memories of the housing project. And I learned very early that, you know, working, I had a paper out in that, but we really changed our lives with my family. I had always had a problem. I played with girls a lot. I mean, it was kind of obvious, I guess. I was going down that road. Boys found, you know, girls didn't wear a lot of makeup in those days, and I was very pretty. and boys liked it. And so anyway, boys created a lot of problems for me, so I played with girls. We had a lot more in common, and we got along. They didn't call me names, and so the reality is, my job that changed that family, I got a job at the A&P supermarket carrying groceries, Thursday night, Friday night, and all day on Saturday, and that's when I start buying. We never had a pop-up toaster, believe it or not. I walked into Major Appliance on 32nd and Halstead Street. And I said to the man, I would like to buy my mother something. What do I do? And he said, what you do is you make payments, and then when it's paid, I'll give it to you. And I said, it made sense to me. I said, great. So I bought our first pop-up toaster. I bought our first window fan. We had an old rickety kitchen table, which I bought this huge Formica kitchen table with chrome. It had so much chrome, it looked like an old Cadillac. It was so beautiful. And I bought a kitchen table and chairs and everything I learned from the movies. Eventually, I knew people that had I've always wanted better things for myself and for my family. And eventually, I knew people in the movies. They had end tables and a coffee table and lamps. That was very important to me. I bought one table at a time, one lamp at a time. And, you know, I'm so grateful. You know, I am so grateful. And my mother did give a lot of beatings in that family with belts, and I got a lot of beatings, unfortunately. And I told my mother, I confronted her one time in sobriety about child abuse, and she said to me, but look at how nice you turned out, you know. And I said, you know, they didn't know any better, and God bless her, you know. And she did, you know what? To sum it all up, they did the best they could. That's what I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous. For gratitude, be grateful, and be grateful for, try and remember all the good stuff, not all the bad stuff. And you know, when I look back, I felt so bad about myself. I had a lot of problems growing up. You know, the way I looked and the way I sounded created a lot of problems for me. And I hated school, and the reason why I hated school is kids were always, you know, making fun of me. And so what happened is, I don't know about you, but I never had any male friends. I believe, for alcoholism, I believe that I was destined to be an alcoholic. I mean, I have no doubt about it. And that's what has actually made my sobriety easy. The fact that I was able to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and then actually, I didn't realize until I had gotten here that, my God, all the alcoholics in my family, which made it easier for me to stay here. And then I was able to look back on my drinking and the little bit of drugs that I did, and I was not a happy camper when I first got here. I was not grateful. I remember being at my first meeting at 26 and Broadway, and I did not share, Donald Madden was the man that 12-stepped me, but I was not the guy that said, oh, thank God I'm here. I remember saying to myself, like, oh my God, I had trouble being a man, then I became gay, and now I'm an alcoholic. Why? Why me? Why do I have to get all this stuff? But it's just the way it is. So anyway, the reality is, where was I? Before that, the housing projects, the furniture. Anyway, so I believe I was destined to be an alcoholic. What happened is, for the first time when I was in the eighth grade, I had a male friend. I'll never forget him. His name is Donnie T, and I still remember where he lived in the housing project, where we lived, on the corner. And Donnie Thielen, I liked a little. I didn't know anything about whatever, but I liked Donnie a little more than being a friend. And I was willing to go to any length to be his friend. He was my first real male friend. And I don't know about you, but in the old days, we had good girls. We had not so good girls, and we had real bad girls. I'm sorry, that's the way it was in the 40s and the 50s. And the only thing that I knew about those girls is how they were. In Chicago, they wore babushkas. And the good girls, I have my own babushka. You may see me on the strip later tonight. The good girls, remember, I'm so grateful. We all went to Catholic school. I did stay away from the priest. And I knew it. One thing I got to look back on my life. My father was unavailable, and that was his problem. He could not be available for me, and I understand that today. But my mother, without saying a lot of stuff, she instilled certain things that we knew, certain things that were not right and were not wrong. And my mother always said, if something's wrong, you come and tell me. So a lot of things happened, but I stayed away from it. But the reality is, the good girls that I always associated with, the little Catholic girls, they always wore their babushka like this. And remember, girls didn't wear makeup. And they were such a good girl, and she could be my friend. And girls that were not so good would have it back a little bit and have it like this, have it on their chin. And I thought, well, she's a little bad girl, but she's okay. She can be my friend. But a real bad girl would have it in a knot in her mouth like this, have it way back. She'd have makeup on, and she'd have her hair in a ponytail. And I don't know what happened, but I was terrified of the bad girls. I would see a bad girl coming down the street, I would actually cross the street. Because, I don't know, somehow I felt it was going to rub off on me. And I learned later in life I wanted to be a bad girl. And they were doing all the things I didn't even know about, you know, I wanted to do. But the reality is, my friend Donnie wanted to make it with this bad girl, and her girlfriend wanted me. And that was news to me. And I thought, oh, he said, Joe, you got to do it. And I was willing to go to any length. And we ended up in a junkyard one night in a bandit truck. And the girls brought little candles. Now, these girls had been around the block a couple of times. And I had never, and remember, I am a short, I actually got this tall in second year of high school. I was a short little boy for a long, long time. And I remember opening those eyes that night. I've never seen that girl before in my life. She looked like the Jolly Green Giant. She was so big and so happy, and she was so excited to see me. She went running to the back of the truck, and Donnie and his girlfriend stayed in the front of the truck. And it was one of the, when I remember, when I look back on all my drinking or drugging or whatever, I have never experienced more fear or terror that I experienced that very night. Never. I have never experienced that. By the time, it was one of the slowest walks I have ever taken in my life. And by the time I got back there, they had blown their candle out. I got somewhere near her, and she blew our candle out. And I don't ever remember rooming being quite that dark. It was dark in that room. And I thought, and I was a little boy, and I knew what I was supposed to do. And I thought, my God, I can't see anything. But so I started to prepare myself, and I thought, I've got to check it out. Now, remember, I am low to the ground standing, so I just start feeling around that truck, and I touched something, and it was a little furry, and I let out a scream. I said, oh, my God, there's an animal in here, you know? And the rest is history. We got dressed real quick. We came out of the truck. Donnie went that way, those girls went that way, and I went that way, and I've never seen any of them since. And I never did get myself in that situation again. And I don't know about you, but dancing became very popular. I am so grateful. I mean, this young girl at 16, it's fabulous to get sober, but in my early teens, it was teen club, dancing, jitterbugs, taking the girls out for hamburgers and french fries, and it was the best time, and the girls were wearing all those petticoats, a lot of chiffon, and I would fantasize when I'd see them in those dresses that I was in them, and but I became a fabulous dancer. I was the jitterbug king of Bridgeport, the cha-cha king. I start running with this rich group of Lithuanian girls, and I became the polka king, and I had a ball. I just had a ball. I loved dancing. And the reality is, it was a good time. But that's when I start drinking. Then in my third year of high school, I was running with this bunch of rich Lithuanian girls. Their fathers always had brand new cars. I would drive them. Remember, girls were not wearing makeups, and I was prettier than most of the girls. And we'd all have our babushkas on, and the guys would always be chasing our car and whatever. And the guys wanted to get to know these girls, and this group of guys said. The girl said, we'll have nothing to do with you unless you become Joe's friend. And they said, we don't have a problem with him. Anyway, so they accepted me. And the only thing the girls had told me is that, could you drink? And I said, well, I had a little drink. Drinking was not my thing. I didn't think about drinking. And I said, well, I've had a little sips of beer or whatever at home. They said, well, the rumor is they drink 3 quarts. Could you drink 3 quarts? And I said, well, I could try. You know, so anyway, I didn't think much about it. And we bought quart bottles in those days in brown paper bags. And I drank 3 quarts with no problem. And my one friend, John, he had a brand new black 59 Chevrolet Impala. It was all black, red interior. And it had, we used to paint the lights on inside red. And I thought that was a real hot car in those days in Chicago. Now when I look back, it looked like a whorehouse on wheels, you know. And we were all drinking and we had a ball. We just had a ball. But what happened has changed my life. I kind of fell in love with one of those boys. And that nothing really happened, but that's when a lot of things changed. And eventually I broke off from all that and I quit high school my last semester. What happened too is, my mother, my brother got married. My sister got pregnant and married at 16. My mother and I moved out of the housing projects. My mother called me one night on the phone and said, I'm not coming home. Go and live with the Gedritis, this Lithuanian family. I used to date their daughter. And she said, they love you like a son. Go, I couldn't live with my father. He lived with my grandmother. So I had to go. So I called them on the phone and said, do you think I could come and live with you? I have nowhere to go. My mother's not coming home anymore. And they said, come here. The only thing is you have to go back to high school. So they made me go back to high school and finish. I got my diploma. I'm so grateful for them. We're so close today. And the reality is, and they thought I didn't have a flair for, I wasn't a book person. But I had a flair. My sisters used to wear rollers to bed, my adopted sisters. They used to say we'd be out dancing and go to dance and stuff. Joe, help me roll my hair. And I'd roll their little rollers in their hair. They'd have toilet paper and cotton and whatever. Remember in the old days, it was wild. They thought I had a flair for hair, believe it or not, encouraged me to go to beauty school. And when my own family heard it, no way, they thought the capital G now was posted on my gay. Now he's a hairdresser. Forget it, you know. In the late 50s and early 60s, that was not a good thing. But anyway, I became a hairdresser, and thank God, because it made my life a lot easier, you know. And no one made fun of me in the beauty shop. So anyway, I'm moving on. The reality is, eventually, I got my own apartment. Eventually, I start drinking. I don't know about you, but when I look back on drinking, it worked. It worked real well for a long, long time. I did not know about drugs. There was no such thing as drugs in Chicago. What happened, and I don't know about you, but when you look back on your life, I think I was drawn to alcoholics. I definitely was drawn to alcoholics, and I was drawn to people that would abuse me or use me. I remember I finally met Mr. Alcoholic, I used to throw him out. He'd come back, throw him out. We'd have fist fights and moving automobiles, and one would be thrown out and whatever. It was insanity, just insanity. Eventually what happened is we moved out here, believe it or not, in 1967. And the only thing that when we moved out here in 1967, I didn't tell him about this, but I said in my mind, there will be no more physical violence. I was tired of fighting. I did not want to fight anymore. And we ended up in an apartment. He had a high-powered job, I had to go back to school. I got a job at the Broadway department store working, putting stock. I had to go back to beauty school to get take my license. What happened is everything stayed the same, and what happened is I did something I never did before in that relationship. I left. I just left one day. I didn't go back. I left the furniture, the dishes and everything, and I ended up on 9th and Montana in the single apartment. The whole apartment was not even as big as the stage. A little sleeping room, a bathroom, and a kitchen, and that's where I believe that when I ended that relationship, that's when I crossed the invisible line. That's when I start drinking out of a 4-cup Pyrex measuring cup. Now, this is not normal. You know what happened? My uncle, I had an aunt and uncle out here, lived in California, my father's sister. They were very wealthy, had a lot of money, very sick, no children, and just, he was a full-blown alcoholic. She was a bad Al-Anon. She should have drank more, whatever. And the reality is that, I hate to say this, but they were two of the sickest people that I have ever met in my life. I was locked into that, I knew I was going to get that trust fund one day. My aunt promised me $1 million. I thought, praise the Lord. But anyway, my aunt started bringing me booze. She said, my uncle was in sales and all that. He'd get a lot of booze. She used to throw it down the drain. She said, she brought me 8 bottles of bourbon one day. She said, stop drinking all those mixed drinks and that beer. You get bloated and a lot of gas. Learn to drink it straight. I said, Aunt Helen, I hate straight booze. It has a bitter taste. She said, you will acquire a taste. Aunt Helen left that night. She brought me a little Waterford glass. She put a few ice cubes, poured a little bourbon in it. I still remember the taste. It was so bitter. But when Aunt Helen left that night, I thought, well, I never could stock a bar. I never had booze in my house. Whatever I had, I drank it. Well, the reality is, when Aunt Helen left that night, now, I spent a lot of time getting ready to go out. I love bars. Drinking, bars, and men all went real well, and it worked real well for me. I'm a single person. I always wanted to be single. You know, one-nighters are my claim to fame. But the reality is, I like everything cold, and I never took a bottle in a room and would drink out of it or that. I always did pour it in a glass, but what happened is I was in the bathtub. I spent a lot of time in the bathtub doing my hair and nails and whatever. I love the bathtub. And I play Edie Gourmet. Some people don't even know who Edie Gourmet is, you know. They come up to me after a meeting, who is Edie Gourmet? I said, she used to sing songs. Edie Gourmet and Barbara Streisand Records. And I knew very early, I didn't know it was alcoholism, that he was not going to be ready for me until about 12:30, 12:15. So why go out early? I could not afford it. So I stayed home and played my music and got ready and ironed my clothes. Didn't have a lot of clothes in those days, so you have to re-iron things and whatever. I liked it cold, and I thought, now I'm smoking a little bit of marijuana, and I thought, you know, sometimes I used to, from so much booze, just I used to get a little limp. You know, my whole body would get limp, and I'm still trying to get ready. And sometimes I'd come to in my apartment, that little apartment, I had big ashtrays, and I'd look, and there'd be like 5 new lit cigarettes, and I'd think, oh my God, someone must be in my apartment, you know, and no one was in my apartment. I just forgot. I lit one, and then I lit another, and then I lit another, and it was just like this class, you know. I thought, well, I would say to myself, now I like everything cold, and I like a lot of ice, and I was coming out of the bathtub. I thought, that little glass is not working in the bathtub. So when I opened the kitchen cupboard, this is what I got out of my divorce. I thought, now this would be a good glass, because now I'm smoking that marijuana, I get a little limp. And I would say to myself, well, did I put my drink down? I wouldn't hear it, but when I put this down, oh, I put it down, I heard it. I put my drink down, I heard it. You gotta hear sounds, you know, and I heard it. And then when I would pass out in the bathtub, thank God, when this was on the side of the bathtub, it never fell. I created tidal waves a lot in the bathtub. I used to pass out. I always had leaky bathtubs. I hope that never happens nowadays. God may not be too great with me, but the water always leaked out. I come in the bathtub 4 or 5 in the morning, you know, thank God the water had gone down, or I'd be on the floor all wet. I'd say to myself, did I just get out of the tub, or did I do something else? It all started in that little apartment, you know, and it never got any better. But this is not normal. You know, I got to remember that. I hope I never forget this. You don't have bourbon on the rocks, vodka on the rocks. My friends would see me out sometimes. They would say, Joe, how much did you drink? I said, I only had 3, 4, or 5. You know, they didn't know, and I didn't hide it. Even when, by the time I got the Alcoholics Anonymous, I had a lot of stuff, and I was still drinking out of this. This was my glass being alone. I liked it. It worked real well. And the reality is, and what happened is, you know, it just got more bizarre. And actually, when I look back on my drinking, everything started in that little apartment. I remember my friends used to come on the weekend. I would wake up on a Sunday morning in that little room, and there'd be 10 guys. You know, my friends, because everybody wanted to go to the beach. And if they would go home, they all lived in Hollywood in those days. If they went home, they would never come down to the beach. So they would pick someone up in the bar and bring them to my place. And before you know it, I'd wake up on a Sunday morning. There were 8 or 9 of us and all laying on the floor and whatever. You know, they want to go to the beach. And one thing I learned in that family is to eat. I always ate food, thank God. I'm so grateful for that. No matter how sick I got from alcohol, that I ate. And I remember I always cooked something and threw it in the oven. And I remember this one Sunday, I had gone, the market was right across the street, I had gone and bought a turkey. And they had turkeys on sale, like a 12-pound turkey. And I remember being so out of it Sunday morning, I was mixing this dressing, and my friends kept saying, Joe, let's go, we want to get to the beach. They just want to drink more. And we're already smoking marijuana and drinking. And I said, wait, let me get this together. And I kind of came to, and I looked like I had 12 pounds of dressing in this bowl. And I thought, my God, where did all this dressing come from? So I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know. The oven was too small anyway to put it on the side. So I got a rubber mallet. And I just start stuffing that bird. And I put him in the front and the back. And when I rolled him in, he looked like 27 pounds, you know. And I rolled that bird into the oven. And we went off to the beach. And we came back many hours later, and you know, you put it on low and it cooks. And I remember coming back to that apartment, and there must have been at least 8 of us. And we always sat in the late 60s, early 70s, even when I had the most beautiful furniture, I always sat on the floor. I was comfortable on the floor because things were not always predictable when I was on furniture. And so here we are. We sat on the floor. I had a narrow Formica coffee table. It must have been this wide. It was long. We all sat around it in those days. We always shared things. You know, you're always passing marijuana around. And the only thing I can remember that Sunday is we heard an explosion. And the only thing, one thing when you're out of it, when you hear in the late 60s, early 70s, an explosion was not a lot of noise. It would go poof. You know, we were so out of it, it didn't make a lot of noise. Well, we heard an explosion, and the next thing I know, we're all sitting on the floor. I swear to God, this bird come flying out of the kitchen. This bird landed on the edge of the coffee table and just kind of slid in the middle. And I remember all my friends going, wow, you know? And I thought, oh my God, what is it? And I thought, well, you know, you didn't question anything. So I thought, well, I think I better get up. And it must be a new bird. It just comes out when it's ready, you know. And so I got up and got the plates and the silverware. It blew his ass off in the kitchen. But it was good. We ate it. It was fabulous. And so it's those kind of things that's not normal. That's not normal drinking, you know. And then eventually, what happened is I slept with everybody in Santa Monica, so I finally moved to Hollywood. We weren't getting any tourists and no new bartenders. So I went on to Hollywood, and I kind of, you know, and I was in the hair business. I one thing about in the early 70s, a lot of drinking was going on in the beauty shop. I didn't know about a lot of drugs. I'm so grateful, but a lot of drinking. And anyway, it was a bad scene, and I just couldn't cope with it. You know, I really couldn't cope with it. I remember when this, I kind of, you know, they talk about careers, and I think I just couldn't cope with the drinking and all the insanity. I believe it was a lot of insanity going on in the beauty shop. I had OD'd one time. I didn't show up at the beauty shop. The beauty shop was actually right down the street from the Friars Club in Beverly Hills on Little Santa Monica. And thank God they came looking for me that one time I was drunk. I've only committed suicide when I was drunk. And I had OD'd on pills around 3 or 4 in the morning. I was so drunk, I remember uncapping a new bottle of vodka and drinking it. And I remember I opened a jewelry box. Someone gave me all these pills. I never took them, but I kept them. And I took them that night, that early morning. I remember them. They looked like M&Ms. I was so out of it. I remember them just kind of falling. And the only thing I remember when I went to my bedroom, I just wanted out. I just wanted out. And what happened, I didn't show up at the beauty shop. They came looking for me. I'll be forever grateful. And they knocked the door down, dragged me out of that apartment, walked me for a day up and down the Little Santa Monica behind in the alley. And I remember someone was always holding me and making me drink coffee. It was pouring all over my clothes. I kept saying, please let me sit down. Customers were coming, looking. They were like amazed, what's going on with him? And I remember after that incident, customers said, I can't believe it would be someone like you. You're always so happy in the beauty shop. I said, but I've always told you, when I go home, I'm a different person. And that's when the alcoholic would take over. So anyway, so I finally kind of came to one day in the beauty shop. I was so out of it, and I felt this swirling motion, and you know, and I don't know about you, but I thought, oh my God, it must be an earthquake. You know, I just felt like everything was kind of moving, and I kind of came to, and I thought, oh my God, I'm in the beauty shop, and I had a brush in my hand, and it was going around like this, and I heard this woman saying, Mr. Joseph, Mr. Joseph. They called me Mr. Joseph in those days, and I thought, oh my God, I'm in a beauty shop. And then she said, Mr. Joseph, my beehive is a little bit on an angle. You know, it was like this. And I said, don't worry about it. Just turn your head a little bit. So anyway, so I think that was the last hairdo I did. If you ever saw anyone in Beverly Hills with a beehive and holding their head like this, that was one of mine. Anyway, so I'm the only hairdresser in Beverly Hills that start cleaning beauty shops in Beverly Hills. How I did that, it's a miracle, especially after the bars closed. But I did it, and then eventually I start cleaning houses. I love to clean, believe it or not. And I started this little house cleaning business. I am the president and the only employee, believe it or not. I know I don't look like an employee, but I am. And I remember I went to this gay organization. They're all presidents of their companies and that. And I said, I used to have Cleaning Ladies Unlimited and president on my card, Joseph Fitzgerald. But on the back, I put, and the only employee. And they were like, oh, dear. You know, they couldn't deal with it. But that's okay. I loved it. I've been doing it for over 30 years. I clean for the rich, not so famous. I wear these huge feather dusters, and I rollerblade my way through these huge mansions. I make a lot of money. I've been so lucky, you know, and I've said, I know it's not, it's made me a millionaire, believe it or not. I've worked so hard. I am so grateful. I start buying real estate and, you know, whatever. And what happened that got me here is my father moved out here, that man that I never had much of a relationship. And he moved out here from Chicago. He was drinking 7 days a week. He said, Joe, if I retire in Chicago, he was here one Christmas. It was 80-something out. We went down to Venice Beach and all that. When he went back to Chicago, he got off the plane, it was 20 below zero. My father called me from the airport. He said, I'm going to work tomorrow, and I'm going to retire. And he said, if I come to California, you'll call me. You'll come over. We'll go bicycling. If I stay here, your brother and sister are busy raising their children. They don't have time for me. He said, I know your lifestyle. I want to be part of your life, and you'll be part of my life. And anyway, so he came. It took him a couple of months to get rid of everything. He moved out here. He stayed with me for 3 months in West Hollywood. And He got an apartment at Park La Brea, and he said he loved, I had a gorgeous apartment. My father liked nice things, and he said, get your decor, I want, he loved my apartment. Exactly, he wanted his apartment to look just like mine. I said, great, so we get your decorator friends over here, and we went running over there, and when I look back on it, it looked so gay, you know. For a man on the railroad, it was very gay. Palm trees and crystal chandelier, and you had butter yellow carpet all the way through. And he loved it. He was never so happy in his whole life. He never drove anymore. He was now going to buy a car and start driving. He wasn't drinking. And what happened is he died. He had a massive heart attack a year and a half later. He lived for a year and a half. I bought him a bicycle. I bought him the tennis bag. He used to play tennis every day. And that was the beginning of an end, the end of his life, but the beginning for me, because I was so angry at that point. When he died, I remember crying out. If God would have said to me, now I've been trying a lot of suicide up to that point. If God would have said to me, it's either your father or you, I would have said, take me, my bags are packed. But it don't work that way. And unfortunately, he went. So I remember crying out. 8 months later, I remember crying out. I was so drunk. I'd been on the streets. I closed the bar. It was 3 a.m, and I did not know it was alcoholism. But I remember looking in my apartment. I had a lot of mirrors in those days. And I remember my face was so blood red. I had a lot of broken veins in my face and whatever. I was real thin. I was losing a lot of weight. And I remember I thought of my father that night. I said, I thought of my father. My Irish grandmother, Sadie, the woman I loved the most, and my Uncle John, who died of cirrhosis of the liver, I said, Dad, Graham, Uncle John, help me. I think I'm just losing my mind. I didn't know it was alcoholism. And the next day I woke up, I swear, I thought of AA. Because early 70s, they start doing the 20 questions on TV, believe it or not. And I remember my father would be over, my aunt and uncle would come over. I loved to cook. And I used to cook a lot, and my neighbor, I lived in an alcoholic building in West Hollywood, and I'd have them all over, and they would do the 20 questions on TV. And my aunt, I still hear her laughing, anybody could answer those, you know what I mean? Well, we were all alcoholics. We always got 18 or 19 at least, you know? So anyway, so the reality is I called AA that morning. I'll never forget it. I made that call, and I believe this is a gift from my father, because my father, I think finally, he was looking down. He told me one time, I used to go over to my father's apartment at Park La Brea. He was short. The top of his head was here. So we've never really hugged, facing each other, kissed each other. But I remember I'd go over to Park La Brea. I did love my father. I would go over there, and he'd be cooking or doing something in the sink, and I would always go and throw, he had a little bit of a stomach. I'd go and throw my arms around him, and I'd always kiss him at the top of his head like this. And he'd say, what are you doing? And I'm, you know what I mean? He never told me not to do it. I'm so grateful. And I'm so grateful I was able to do that, because I did love him. And he told me one time, we were sitting at the table, he said, he looked right at me, and I'll never forget that. He said, you remind me so much of me. It's unbelievable. And, you know, I thought, does he know what he just said? You know what I mean? I thought, it kind of went through my head. I didn't know about alcoholism. And we never discussed that anymore. Nothing was ever said. But I realized today what he saw was alcoholism. And I believe when I cried out that last time, he said, my son and my daughter, Patrick and Helene, they needed the money. That'll help them. But Joe, he doesn't need the money. He needs Alcoholics Anonymous, and let's give it to him. And I believe that was a gift from my father. And I jumped into AA. I called AA, and I called AA around. I went to work that day, cleaned all my houses, came home, didn't drink that day, cleaned my apartment. I called AA around 11:30 that night, showered and shaved. I was sitting in bed. I called AA, and the woman said, I'll have a man call you. Will you be up in an hour? I said, I'm waiting. I didn't know what I was waiting for. And Donald Madden was the man that called me. He said, are you okay? I said, yes. And that's the name of the game. Even in long-term sobriety or newcomers or whatever, say yes. Be willing. I had the willingness. And he said, you know, don't drink. You have to come to my house tomorrow to go to me. I said, yes, yes, yes. Anyway, and the next day I went to work, did all my work. Came home, I was getting dressed. I live in an alcoholic building now. My friends came up and they said, where are you going? You're getting all dressed up so early. And I said, I bet you'll never guess where I'm going. And they said, well, you're the funny one in the building. You all do funny things. I said, I'm going to AA. AA, they kind of looked at each other and they said, you really did it this time. And, you know, and they left. And I thought, oh my God, what did I do? You know, but anyway, I got in. I had a 73 Coupe de Ville. I had a lot of things in those days. I had my gabardine slacks. I got all dressed up, and I drove over. I didn't know what alcoholics looked like. I had a 73 Coupe de Ville butter. It was the most beautiful yellow with a white vinyl top, all white leather interior, the most beautiful Cadillac I'd ever owned. And I drove over to Donald Madden's house, and when I pulled in his driveway, he had a gorgeous home. He had a brand new 1975 Eldorado convertible, and I thought, it just kind of went through my head for 1 minute. I thought, oh my God, these alcoholics must be doing pretty good. And I went into his house, and I'll never forget it. I was standing on the doorstep. So we never know how we're going to give the program to people. I was standing on the doorstep, and he was looking right at me. I just met him. And he said, by the way, we don't drink. And I said, oh, okay. And he said, by the way, do you ever take any other things? And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, do you ever take pills? I said, oh, pills. I was so honest, thank God. I said, yeah, well, I do take Valium Librium from the doctor. Doctor prescribed. He said, And I said, I take diet pills. I said, but I only take these on the weekend when we drive to Palm Springs around 4, 5, 6 in the morning. It keeps us awake when we close the bars. And I said, I do smoke marijuana, but I just smoke it on my way out of when I'm leaving my apartment, because if I too smoke it too early, I'm still in the bathtub at 2:30 in the morning, you know. And I said, I do use emyl nitrate but I said I only use it for sex, dancing, and when I want my long hair to fluff up a little bit. He said, and then he looked at me and he said, we don't do any of that. And I thought, oh, I felt at that point, I thought I was standing on a rug and he had just pulled it. And I didn't know what, you know, I only thing I could tell you in the old days, I'm just telling you, I'm from the old school. I did not know. I was ready. I guess I was ready. I didn't know you could say, well, too bad. I'm out of here. I said, okay, if that's what you have to do, then that's what you have to do. I was ready. And I did it. I got rid of it all and whatever. I'll be forever grateful. And then he was my sponsor for a couple of months. And I really had a hard time dealing with men most of my life. So when I got sober, I saw this little art lady in Beverly Hills, Molly B. And I used to say to my, now all my, I stuck with peers. We were all newcomers. We all went to meetings. We all had commitments. We were just very active in AA. And I remember my friends kept saying, you better get a sponsor. They knew it was not working out with him and me. You better get a sponsor. And I said, you know, Molly, every time where I go, it seems to be Molly. She used to have Gucci bags and Gucci clothes. And I said, and all this twisted blonde hair like Christine. And the reality is, I remember one Tuesday we went to 2+2 and she was there. And then I remember we went to Brentwood and she was the main speaker. And I said, oh my God, Molly's here. My friend said, you better ask her. So I got in line and I remember going up to thank her. That probably the hardest thing I had ever done in AA. I remember going up to thank her that night. And I remember thanking her for her talk. And I said, Molly, I was going to ask you, would you be my sponsor? And I never really met her. She saw me from meetings, and she said, I would love to be your sponsor. I thought, oh, my dear. So she gave me her card. She said, please call me. I want you to come to see me on Saturday because I'm going away for a while, and I'm going to worry about you. I just talked to her. I could not believe it. So I remember leaving Brentwood. I'll never forget it. I'm going down San Vicente with my friends. I was dancing in the street. I've got a sponsor. You know, it was fabulous. And so anyway, and she was great. She was my sponsor for the first 16 months of my sobriety, and I will ever be grateful. And Donald Madden said all the magic words too that night. He said, if you drank every day, I suggest you go to a meeting. I said, okay. And if you had a commitment at every meeting, that would help you go back. And I thought, you know what, my track record on drinking and men and whatever, that would. And one thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, when I came here, I did not come here for money, I didn't come here for a car, I didn't come for a job, and I did not come here looking for sex. I came for sobriety, and I'm forever grateful because I love sobriety. This is probably the most important thing that's ever happened to me in my life. And like some of my clients say, what an accomplishment of that sobriety, you know, it's unbelievable. And so anyway, so I jumped into AA, and I remember, and that's the name of the game, being active. And I remember I was 6 months sober, and I called Westwood office, and I said to the lady, I want to help alcoholics. And she said, well, how much sobriety do you have? And I said, well, I only have 6 months. She said, oh, well, you really have to have a year. But she said, if you come and see me, I'll interview you, and we'll see if you could do it. So I thought, well, boy, let me tell you, I got all dressed up. Car was all nice and clean. I went pulling in Westwood in my 73 Coupe de Ville, and she said, well, we can give you a try every other Sunday. I said, great. And I was there for, I think, 5 years, and every other Sunday. And one thing about in the old days, I don't know about 12-step calls. The only ones I know in the beginning is they never stopped drinking. And I like to talk. So I would get these guys or the girls on the phone, and they would tell me all their woes or whatever. And then I would say to them, after talking to them for a long period of time, I would say, now, I have to get someone to come and pick you up and take you to a meeting. And they would always say, no, I've been talking to you for a half hour. You come and get me. And I thought, oh, my dear. I said, well, it doesn't really work that way, but I'll do it. So at the end of Sunday evening, I would have like 3-4 alcoholics I'd have to go and pick up. So our big meeting was Wilshire, Normandy in those days. So I would go barreling around picking these alcoholics. And I remember, you know, my 73 Coupe de Ville. And I don't know about you, but in those days, not many people had Cadillacs. And I remember I'd go and get these alcoholics. Some women had bad hairdos and bad dresses and whatever. And they were always drunk. They didn't stop until I got there. But I would bring them to that car, and I would open. We had lights, a lot of lights in those Cadillacs in those days. And when I would open the door, it would be like, hello, Dolly, you know. And they would say, oh, my God, is this a Cadillac? And I say, it is a Cadillac. And they would always say, I've never been in a Cadillac. I say, well, you're going to be in a Cadillac now, and you're on your way to your first AA meeting. So they would pile in, and I have 3 or 4 in the back seat and 2 or 3 in the front seat. We didn't have seatbelts in those days, and I used to use a lot of Armor All on the leather seats. And I don't know about you, but the Cadillacs were like the 747s. You know, they would, when you went around the corner, they would just kind of barrel like this. And they would just slide from one end to the other. And I remember going down Wilshire Boulevard, and we had power brakes in those days. And I swear to God, they worked real well. I would go barreling on a red light, and that red light would turn red. I'd hit that brake. That car would stop on a dime, but the back end would kind of lift up. And those people would just kind of slide down. Now, there was a lot of room. I remember looking in my rearview mirror one time and thinking, oh, my God, where are they? They're gone. And they would slide under the dashboard. And by the time I arrived at Wilshire, Normandy, you know, I'd go barreling around. I'd always pull up in front of the meeting place. I'd always get out. I had the steering wheel, thank God. It kept me in place. But I would get out. I'd always go and open the door, and they would be intertwined in the back seat. And under, one or two would be under the dashboard. And I'd say, you're at your first AA meeting, you know. And they would like, where are we? You know, they would be so confused. But, you know, I'm forever grateful. There's so many of them. I still know some today are still sober and whatever. So I jumped into Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened is after that 1 year, I don't know about you, but the most fabulous year of my sobriety was my 1 year. I lived for those chips. To be sober a week, 30 days, was unbelievable. And then when I got that 1 year, they didn't talk about the roller coaster, but that roller coaster started, and I was depressed. I had a lot of depressions in alcoholism and in sobriety, but the reality is I got very disenchanted with my friends and whatever, and it seemed like every meeting I went to was someone in the Pacific group in those days. And I used to go to Molly and say, God, I went to this meeting, they were so happy and having a great time, and it was someone from the Pacific group, and they would always get, come to our group, come to our group. And my friends in West Hollywood said, don't you go to that Clancy group, he hates gay people. And I thought, well, maybe they don't know I'm gay. You know, I look like Marlo Thomas in the old days, full brunette. I had a hair in a flip, a lot of hair way out there. So Molly said, you know, the group would be a good group for you. Why don't you give it a try? And I said, oh, well, anyway. So I just started going over there a little bit, and I remember I tried the yard. I was terrified of the yard, and I couldn't stay. I actually had to leave. And the reality is, one day I'll never forget it. And that's why, you know, I have never, And I kind of described the way I looked and the way I sounded growing up. Even in my family, when I walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never had more unconditional love. And I've never had more people say to me, and they always told me this in the early days of sobriety, be yourself. We don't care. Because people were really not talking about being gay in 1975. They just didn't talk about it. I couldn't help not talk about it. Well, I've been the poster boy for being gay, you know. I was born out of the closet. And so the reality is people love me. They accepted me. And when you were, because of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous learned to accept, teach me to be myself, then my family, believe it or not, in sobriety was able to accept me for being what I am and realizing the kind of person I am. So anyway, I jumped into AA and I loved it. And I jumped into the Pacific Group. And what happened is Clancy came up to me one night, and I'll never forget it. Because I had like one, I was terrified, really. I thought maybe I don't belong here or whatever. Maybe what people say is true. And he came up to me one night and he said, Joe, remember, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you want sobriety, we'd love to have you. And I literally jumped into that group, and you know, I just became very active, and I got Clint H. to be my sponsor, and I remember I was working good. I had, believe it or not, when my father died, I had $8,200 I inherited from my father. I never touched it. I left it in the CD. Clint he said, you're making good money. He turned me over to an AA realtor. Mary, who's out here, I think, Mary, she bought, I said, I want this house now. And she said, when you walk in, you'll find the right house. Clint told me, don't sign any papers until I see them all. But you just go look and you do the footwork. And we finally found this little house around the corner from Clancy. Clancy was not too impressed. Ah, Clancy, I just bought a house right around the corner from your house. Oh, my dear. And the reality is, I got that house, and I just sold that house. I've had it for 1,000 years. I sold it for $500,000. Can you believe it? But anyway, so I jumped in and jumped into the Pacific Group and did all my things, and eventually I was, you know, and I loved it. We went on a lot of trips together and did, it was the highlight of my life. But eventually I wanted to get back more involved in the gay people and whatever, and that's what I did, and eventually, through a series of things. I don't know about you, but debt seems to help me a lot. And I've been alone. I've never had another relationship in sobriety, and that's okay. I like it. I'm very happy today. I have three black cats, and Ashley, Taylor, and Paul Joey, and they love me. And if you're lonely, get a cat. They're easy to maintain. That's why I'd have dogs, but I'm gone too much. And but anyway, the reality is I jumped into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love sobriety, and I've just worked a lot, and I stay real busy, and AA's always been at the top of my list. So anyway, how are we doing? Should I just about wind it up? You want to stay till around 11? Anyway, the reality is, you know, so I got involved in the other groups, and then eventually, I don't know, I was talking about debt, but you know, when that my aunt got sick, the aunt and uncle there, I ended up in Al-Anon. I was 5.5 years sober when my mother was thrown out of Chicago with a one-way ticket. She ended up at my house in Venice, and I'll never forget it. And Chuck Nisbet was my sponsor. And I remember opening that door for the first time in my life, opening that door, and my mother was standing there, a full alcoholic and a drug addict through prescription. And for the first time, I opened that door, and I looked at my mother, and I thought, I hate her. I hated her for a lot of reasons. And I remember telling Chuck that. He said, and I'm so grateful for all the people that have helped me. He said, you do not have to love your mother, but you have to respect her. And I thought, oh, easy for him to say. You know, so I ended up in Al-Anon. You go, and he told me, you have to go to Al-Anon. You have to go to 2 meetings a week, plus your AA. I thought, why me? She's the one that needs Al-Anon or AA. No. I went Monday and Friday to Al-Anon, which I'm grateful. I went for 5.5 years. At one point, they were calling me a double winner. And I went for my aunt and uncle. They were two of the sickest people. And eventually, my mother didn't get sober. Eventually, it took me three. But when you look back, eventually, I got her an apartment at Lincoln Apartments, furnished it, paying the rent every month, whatever. 3 years later, I was having such financial problems, I thought I was going to lose that house on Pinmar. I had to go to my mother finally and say, I can't afford you anymore. And she won't do anything for me anyway. And my mother stood up in her living room and said, if you cannot do for me, I don't need you. And I thought, I remember leaving that apartment that day. I never felt so bad in my life. I got my car, and I never saw her for a year. And eventually, she had to leave. She couldn't afford it. Funny thing, when I went back to empty that apartment, she had taken all my brother and sister's pictures and left mine. And that was really, it hurt a great deal. But the reality is, I just couldn't do it anymore. And eventually, believe it or not, which she still had a lot of drinking and drugging, and she ended up out here one more time. I never even saw her. She ended up in the hospital. Then she ended up back in Chicago. And eventually she got sober at 70, believe it or not. And she was sober the last 3.5 years of her life. She didn't come to AA, but she just, finally they start. She ended up in this home in Chicago. And they used to, my sister said, you know, they wrote Ma up for drinking. They'd have her breathe. Charlotte, breathe. Charlotte, you've been drinking. Charlotte's been drinking. And they would frisk her. My mother had big boobs. She'd hide pills in her bra and everywhere. Charlotte's eagle, you know, they stretch her out. They find prescriptions like you would not believe. They said, how does she get all this medication? Every day she goes out, she gets more. Finally, my mother called. I should have saved the message. She called me one day. I'm so ever grateful. She called me on the answering machine. She said, she always called me Joseph. Joseph, this is your mother. I am not drinking and taking any more pills. It's just too much work in this home. And that was the end of it. It's just amazing. She stayed sober. I love it. And eventually that aunt and uncle, I ended up in therapy. I was paying $65. My Al-Anon sponsor, believe me, paid. You know, that's how, I mean, I was against a lot of things when I got sober. I figured, but you know, my Al-Anon sponsor made me go to therapy for my aunt and uncle because of that money. And they used to say the money was on the string and I was going for it. And then finally, being in Al-Anon, I was finally able to say to my aunt one time, I had taken her out to dinner 3 times in 1 week. And every time the bill comes, she always would hold. They just got another 300 and some thousand from his brother when he died. She would hold that purse so tight, I wouldn't ask her to pay for it. So I paid for the bill. But finally, I called her one Wednesday and I said, you know, 1 week. I said, do you know we have been out 3 times this week for dinner and all 3 times. I'm having financial problems. And now I'm taking you out to dinner. You have a million in the bank or more, and you can't. And she was just, how can you say that? I'm saving it for you, you know. Well, anyway, so I didn't see her for quite a while. And eventually she got sick. I heard she was in the hospital. And it turned out she got ovarian cancer. And I was still in therapy. And I remember going to the therapist on a Monday, and I said, my aunt's sick, and I called her. I said, I wanted to come and see you, but if I'm going to go to the hospital and you're going to order me out of the room, I'm not coming. Her lady friend had called me, go and see your aunt. So she said, no, I would love to see you. So I went to see her. So I went one Monday to therapy. I said, my aunt's in the hospital. And the next Monday I went, I said, my aunt had just died. He said, oh my God, no money. My uncle was still alive. He wasn't going to give it to me. I was just beside myself. I thought, oh my God, all my dreams. But anyway, I said to my uncle, I had bought a new 83 Cadillac, and my aunt had an 82 Eldorado. I had a Coupe de Ville. Only mine had payments. Hers was paid for, and my uncle couldn't drive. I said, why don't you just give me the car? I would appreciate it. He said, no, I need the money. So we sold the car and whatever. And finally, I didn't see him anymore. I just had to cut the cord. You know, and that was the best thing I ever did. I didn't need their money. I didn't really want their money. I have more money than they ever had today anyway. I don't need it. You know, that's what we learn in AA. There's so many things. And you know, my aunt resented the fact that now I'm starting to talk back to her. You know, I called her on that dinner stuff and other things and whatever. And that's how alcoholics, it works slowly. It works slowly. So anyway, got over that. So what happened when I didn't get that money, I was so distraught over that I went and borrowed on that little house and I bought a duplex closer to the beach. And then when another aunt died that had a lot of money, I thought maybe she'd remember me. When she died, nothing. Actually, she left me more than my aunt. She left me $2,000 out of a million. $2,000, I thought she must have got the figures wrong. But anyway. As a friend of mine said, you got $2,000 more from her than the other aunt. I said, you're right. So I borrowed on that duplex, and I bought both on both sides of me. And the reality is I kind of overextended myself and had financial problems. I kind of gave up one. I could have kept it, but managed to. I moved in the garage for 6 years, and I turned it all around, and I bought another house 2 years ago. And anyway, it's great. And I just sold that old house. I still have two duplex. I paid them off. Now I'm collecting the rents. I mean, life is good. I have so much, and I've done all the footwork. I am so grateful. Anyway, I got to end it. But the reality is, I could tell you a lot more things. Let me tell you about this one Saturday. You know, and I hated playing baseball. And one thing about, I don't know about you, but in sobriety, I was able, in sobriety, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I did not think a lot about God. You know, being gay, being a Catholic, and being a man was bad. I was going to burn in purgatory anyway, so I couldn't deal with God. But the reality is that when I come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, this is where I don't know about you. I think some people, I don't have to look. They're Sally and Keith, people that I've known so long, they're miracles. They have been miracles as long as, like, when I woke, I think we came out of the womb when we came to AA. You know, I've been watching them all these years, and they were here for me. And I believe they're miracles. We're all miracles. If you're sober 1 hour, 1 minute, and you're in this room, you are a miracle, because we should all be drunk somewhere or dying or driving automobiles loaded. And the reality is, I remember Clancy gave me one of these, and I had to play baseball, you know, and you have to learn. And you know what? The name of the game is, I learned in AA, is do what they're doing. I don't go to this group or that group and say, well, I'm not going to do that. You know, I want what you got, and I'm going to go and do it. So Clancy gave, he said, I remember one Saturday I said, I did not want to play baseball. I never played baseball in my life. And I remember Clancy came up to me one time, and he said, you know, I say, Clancy, no baseball. Remember, I'm an ex-hairdresser, and I'll play volleyball with the girls in the yard. I'd love it. No. He said, I don't usually buy gloves for anyone, but I bought you one. And he said, I want you to put it on your hand. I want you far away from me. Get out there in right field, goddammit. And I thought, oh my God. He sounded like my father. I thought, that's my father. You know what I mean? And I remember I was going out to right field, and I would turn around. Here? No, keep going. Keep going. And that one Saturday I kind of came to, I was standing like in the middle of Rose Avenue between the two yellow lines, and I thought, this doesn't seem right, you know. And then eventually he would say, hey, dummy, come a little closer, you know. And then eventually I went closer. And, you know, I don't know about you, but I was always terrified of getting hit by that goddamn ball. And but one thing, what I'm trying to tell you is you take action. On blind faith, you take action. I always put my hand up. I always close my eyes. But one Saturday, I'll never forget, I got to show you this. One Saturday, I was a little angry at Clancy, so I thought, I created a new jersey. I showed up at the yard, and I had this on, and I was wearing this to play baseball. And I had my glove in my hand, and the backside is like this. Anyway, I was out in right field. I thought, I'll get it. He made a little innuendo gay thing a week before, and I was very upset over it. But I remember having my hand up, had my eyes closed, and I used to use a lot of Super Aquanet on my head. I had a lot of hair in those days. And the only thing I can tell you, if you cannot see the ball, I didn't know, but balls make noise when they come through the air. And the ball, I'd hear the ball go, it would kind of whistle through the air, and I thought, oh my God, it's coming, it's somewhere near. And the only thing is, I had so much hair and so much Aquanet, when it would kind of go over my head, it would create a draft, and my hair would kind of lift up, and then it would come down a little bit. I thought, oh my God, it just went over my head and past me. You know, and I turn around and look, and there the ball, I bend over. 3 years later, I had a sore back from bending over getting that ball. And the reality is, this Saturday, I had my hand up, had my eyes closed. I heard the ball coming through the air, and I heard, and then I felt a little nudge in my glove, and I remember letting out a scream. Oh my God. It was so powerful. I almost fell backward. The force. Oh, I remember going like this. Oh, I brought my other hand up. Oh, I opened my eyes. Now, bases were loaded. They were running real fast. A lot of goddamn dust and dirt was blown all over. But I looked up in my mitt. The ball was in my mitt. What do you do if you're a guy that used to live in West Hollywood, never caught a ball before? I start jumping up and down saying, I caught the ball! I caught the ball! And I remember Clancy happened to be the pitcher that day. And when the dust settled, I remember Clancy yelling out. Now, his face was blood red. It looked like a few veins had broken, and his hair was, it looked like a beehive. His hair was standing straight up, and he yelled out, hey, dummy! When you catch the ball, you don't stand there and jump up and down and say, I caught the goddamn thing. Throw it. And I gave him one of my old beauty shop shuffles, you know, one of the slowest balls he ever waited for. I never did catch another. Eventually, I left the group. God bless you.
Thank you so much.